Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on the programme today.
People are convinced that this is the right thing to do, but it's the how that is difficult. So there is a lot of work on methodology that needs to be done, but I think the convincing has already taken place.
How do we ensure that our city planning includes culture at its very core? On this edition of the show, we look at a new guide aiming to provide a roadmap to more cultural-rich development. We also investigate how cabarets, cafes and clubs have survived throughout the years. And we browse the work of one company aiming to enhance the public realm with their own unique splash of colour. That's all coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to today's show. Now, would you like to know how to put culture at the heart of your city? Well, the Urban Land Institute UK Urban Art Forum, in partnership with the Mayor of London, recently released a new six-step guide to including culture in developments. It identified five types of cultural outputs that are important to our cities, and spaces for cultural consumption are a key part of that. Stories of cultural spaces moving into an area, helping it to flourish, and then being priced out or legislated out are all too common. So how do we ensure these venues remain an integral part of the fabric and benefit from the same growth that they help bring? Well, I'm joined in the studio now by Hala El Achel, who's the chair of the UK Urban Art Forum and director of PLP Architecture, PLP Labs. Hala, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this roadmap to building cultural infrastructure. Firstly, could you just tell us what this report is actually trying to achieve?
So about 2 years ago, we launched a group called the Urban Art Forum with the Urban Land Institute. And we brought around the table architects, developers, artists, local authorities, investors. And what quickly emerged from the conversation is two things. The first one is a lack of shared language. So people were referring to different challenges, issues with using different terminology. And the second thing is not knowing where to start. What is the first step? Who should be involved? And what are the questions we should ask at which stage of the process? And this is why we decided to work on this piece of work.
Why is language important? So give me an example of something you've come to agree on is a good term to describe the work that you're doing. Were people using too many different phrases for the same thing, for example?
I think one of the first steps was to agree to use the GLA-adopted terminology of cultural infrastructure.
So this is the Greater London Authority, isn't
yes.
it, for people not in the UK? Great.
Yes, it's the Greater London Authority. And the reason why cultural infrastructure was an important term to adopt as a group, it's because it refers to both the production of culture and the consumption of culture. So it's not only about a piece of art in the public realm or going to a museum and absorbing what's there, but it's also about the whole ecosystem and supply chain behind that final piece that you see. So that was one of the first thing to do. It's adopt that recognized terminology. The second thing can be as basic as the word, for example, placemaking, which can mean a number of things. And in the case of this guide, we decided to add before the word placemaking, cultural placemaking, because there are different ways to create a place or to transform a space into something that is more connected to the users and so on. And culture is one of the elements. And so we decided to use that terminology. So it's about just building terms and making sure that we all have the same understanding of them.
And tell me, so cultural spaces and cultural infrastructure, what kind of range of things would be included in that? Is it everything from literally the National Theatre in London through to someone's workshop? Is that all part of the same infrastructure?
It is all part of that infrastructure. It can be an artist's studio. It can be an event space. It can be a space where temporary events take place, pop-ups. It can incorporate something that's ephemeral, something that's permanent. So it's all of that ecosystem that creates that underlying cultural network and that makes London so wonderful.
And before we start on the steps and how you start the process, just tell me, I presume that all of these things, I know that the Mayor of London and his deputy have been keen to map London's cultural spaces. They feel that everything from nightclubs to music venues to workshops has been lost in the rush to develop, and developers want to make cash and they knock out spaces that perhaps weren't even registered before, and the city's done a lot to map that. So do you come at this from the point of view that there is a problem? There is a problem that we're losing space and we need to make new and better spaces? Is it a problem that motivated you in the beginning, do you think?
I think there are two things. I would maybe call it an opportunity rather than a problem, because it's a moment where there are some converging forces in the built environment sort of community. So on one side, developers are being pressured more and more by their investors to report on ESG and therefore required to measure their impact. And one of the ways to measure their impact is via culture. The second thing is that local authorities are also being asked by local communities to be more transparent about how some of the planning permissions are being given and how the impact of these are being evaluated. And us as architects, with the fact that we are now able to collect and measure data, we are therefore expected to show and be more articulate about how that impact is captured. So it's sort of an opportunity. It's a moment where these forces are converging and they allow us to respond in a more informed way.
And many of the projects that you've seen in London and you've touched upon in your work, can you give us an example of somewhere you think that is doing interesting work at the moment in this city?
I think that Argent at King's Cross did quite a good job engaging with the communities, programming the retail and the public realm in certain ways and maybe with more of an open mind. And the result is visible. It's a space that is constantly occupied, used by different groups of people, and the offer is different than what you have seen in a number of other regeneration schemes. So I think their approach was quite conscious, meticulous, and the results can be seen and felt.
It's interesting that I think that sometimes when reports like this come out, you think this is you kind of telling people off and saying, look, you need to provide cultural space and look after the community, you're not doing enough. But actually, when you look at all these projects, everyone can win in the end, can't they? They can bring in more people to their communities, they can see an uptick in footfall, people feeling positive about the space. Is that something, which I know is hinted at in the report, that you need to get everyone invested in seeing that this is a positive thing for them too?
Yeah, so it's sort of conveying like the business case for culture almost. So I think from the point of view of a developer, it's one way of engaging and creating a link with an existing community before bringing in a new community, if it's a residential scheme and so on. So it's a way of engaging early on via culture, which is intrinsically linked to identity. So that is one of the first things. Then depending on what the objectives are, you could measure a number of things that talk about that impact. So, for example, if what you wish to achieve is changing the perception of a place that has been, because of its history or sort of has a bad image, and there's something about changing the image, culture can help achieving that. If it's about creating an anchor point and to generate footfall, culture is something that can do that. It can help with the engagement with the local communities. It can help with branding. It can help with the future occupiers. There are a number of aspects of a project that culture can really support in a tangible way.
Another thing in the report is the need to bring on professionals,
yes,
people who know what they're doing. And I guess that's interesting for me is that, again, you sometimes see a development and it's like, oh, we're going to have a gallery on the ground floor. And then you see that gallery 6 months later and there's some dreadful pictures in there and there's nobody in the space. Mm. It doesn't matter if you build cultural space unless you have a programmer, cultural activist, a community liaison person who brings it to life. Mm-hmm. Is that a common error that you, when you all began to meet to discuss this, that where's the professional? Where's the person who knows what's going on here?
Yeah, absolutely, because it's key to have an expert, because it's about determining the key questions that need to be asked at different stages of the project, but also the objectives, because depending on your objectives, you are going to measure different outputs and you're going to establish that. But most importantly, you talked about a gallery. Gallery is one way of expressing culture. The guide talks about five types of cultural outputs. It can be objects and artwork in the public space. It can be cultural infrastructure, spaces of production, so workshops and so on. It can be cultural consumption, so it goes back to the gallery, for example. It can be temporary exhibitions. So examples of that could be the Fourth Plinth or sculpture in the city, and cultural events and activity, which are more festivals, performances, and could also take the form of community participation projects.
Positive about what lies ahead? Do you feel excited and charged up, or do you feel, oh my God, we have so many people to persuade here to make this happen?
I think it's an interesting time, because I think people are convinced that this is the right thing to do, but it's the how that is difficult. So there is a lot of work on methodology that needs to be done, but I think the convincing has already taken place. It's the same with, you don't question anymore if you have to deliver something that addresses sustainability. You don't question anymore if you have to deliver something that addresses some of the social issues that are pertaining to your site's culture. It has become one. So the convincing has taken place, but it's the how, it's the methodology that is the next big step or the next challenge.
Well, Hala El Akel, thank you very much for joining us. And you can read the report yourself at uk.uli.org. Go on, have a go. You could change your city tomorrow. We know that live performance spaces for art, music and theatre, venues where people can express themselves freely, are important for cities and their residents. And while such venues invite laughter and dancing and are a boon to economies, as we've discussed, they also bring with them plenty of conflict, from noise complaints to soaring property prices. Which begs the question, what can be done to ensure that such spaces continue to thrive in spite of such challenges? Recently, the Barbican in London hosted Into the Night, an exhibition which celebrated the creative spaces where artists congregated between the 1880s and the 1960s to push the boundaries of artistic expression. Well, we sent along Monocle's Nick Manise to assess the importance of these creative hubs within their communities. Let's have a listen.
Spaces where art and music can be performed and where people have freedom to express themselves are important to cities. From the cabarets of 19th century Europe to the nightclubs of present-day Berlin, cultural venues are, and have been, crucial to the economic, social and physical development of our cities. They stimulate the local economy and they're critical to the establishment of neighbourhood identity. The presence of music venues and art galleries are also key to attracting talented and ambitious people to urban places. And for these people, they offer an escape from the minutiae of daily life. There are few better feelings than blowing off steam by laughing along to some live stand-up comedy. Equally, cultural venues are important spaces for the people who perform in them. We only have to look at the earliest iterations of such venues, the cabarets of late 19th century Paris, for evidence.
Well, they were extremely vibrant places for artists to meet. They allowed them to express ideas and expressions and art that they were not able to communicate otherwise, not able to necessarily express in the context of the studio, in the context of the academy or the salon. So it became a really like almost a safe space, a place where they could meet and collaborate, and also where artists from very different disciplines, writers, poets, illustrators, journalists, painters could try to meet and find similarities within their work.
That was Florence Ostend, the curator, writer and art historian behind the Barbican's recent exhibition exploring cabaret culture.
Every single book about cabarets and clubs will always quote the Chat Noir in Montmartre as being the very first cabaret, artistic cabaret in history. The reason why it emerged is because Montmartre was a very lively district for entertainment, for performing arts, and a group of writers and poets met in another part of the city and found the district of Montmartre could be an incredible space inside the city where both of the ideas in terms of literature could be understood and performed in the context of the district of Montmartre, which was promoting entertainment and performance art. So it's really this really unique moment in history, but also in the urban landscape of Paris, that provoked the meeting point between an intellectual circles from the left bank with the entertaining district of Montmartre.
As Florence highlights, the contribution of cultural venues to their surrounding neighbourhood and local community can't be overstated. But so often, such venues are under threat. Their success is what ultimately leads to their downfall. It's a story played out time and time again. Artists and their associated venues move into an area. Here, they create cultural capital that ultimately drives up the price of rent, and soon they have to move on. Or, if they manage to stay, they can find themselves in legislative battles with new residents, who, whilst enjoying the vibrancy and entertainment space brings, are ultimately frustrated by the noise or crowds associated with them. Which raises the question, what role can and has the law played in the evolution of cultural venues?
Well, laws are changing depending on what happens in history. In the 30s in Germany, when the rise of fascism was taking place in the city, you had several laws that were meant to censor nightlife activities in Berlin. So there was a reaction on official laws and regulations depending on in what time or historical moment you are in.
It seems that today, local governments, who recognise the economic and social benefits cultural venues bring, are working to support and protect them. Indeed, in the UK, agent of change laws have been introduced. These protect established venues from developers building new residential properties near clubs and live music, by placing an onus on the developer to ensure that new homes are adequately soundproofed. Better still, cities like Berlin are sinking hundreds of thousands of euros into citywide soundproofing projects. It's a welcome move, given that in the past 10 years, some 200 clubs have closed, many due to conflicts with new residents. Such legislation is recognition of the importance of these spaces to cities, and one that others around the world would be wise to consider. For Monocle, I'm Nick Manese.
Finally today, we head to Paris, where a group of friends got together to bring a splash of colour to the Gare du Nord train station. Little did they know that they would be starting a movement to elevate the role that urban art can have in our cities. Quai 36 started in 2015, when 22 French and international artists painted several areas of Gare du Nord to greet some of the 700,000 daily commuters that roam through it. 5 years on, and the project has expanded to other parts of the French capital, celebrating the city as a collective space for all. Well, I'm joined now in the studio by Jonas Remus, who's the president of the organisation. Welcome to the show, and tell us, how did this project begin for you?
This project began when I was in the train going to my parents, actually. So I was a student in Paris, and my parents are living in a neighbourhood just like 50 minutes away. So I was used to take the train from Gare du Nord. And one night, I was on platform 34, I guess, on top of my mind. And I was speaking with a friend, and there was this new train that were coming up. You know, like initially we have what we call the petit gris, like small grey train, and they totally changed them. I had this feeling that it was bringing a lot of dignity to people, you know, like to have these new services. So I got into the train to go to my parents, and once the train started, when we were leaving the platform, I remember seeing whole graffiti starting, you know, when we just got out of the train station. And I had this feeling it was like with the movements, like they were trying to get inside, you know, like a barbarian outside of the city, you know, and trying to get into it. Just like, you know, the apple falling from the tree, as it feels to me that it made sense to bring art into people's life, into this travel temple. You know, it's so big, and it was so sad in a way, like these grey walls all around us.
And did you know already
many of the artists you then approached to come and make this art? Did you know them already, or you started from zero?
I mean, I was used to the art field because of my education, because I love art, but I was not specialist in any kind with street art. But it felt to me that it was one of the greatest expression of contemporary art nowadays, and street is an amazing place for creativity. And so the idea came up, like, and I was, okay, we need to do something. I need to bring street art into this street station. It was like all this graffiti was like trying to fecundate, you know, like to get inside this temple. And so I started to talk with friends, and some of them were like, okay, it sounds crazy, like French National Railways, usually they're like not really keen on doing anything with street artists, you know, like, and they have issue, you know, some people are dying on railroads trying to graffiti train. So it's kind of an issue to them. But I started to build the idea. We started to work with friends, and then I met the head of the communication of French National Railways. I managed to do that. It's a department called Gare et Connexion, Train and Connection, and they manage the development of the 3,000 train station we have in France. And I told them the idea, and they were like, that seems like something great we could do. But to get there, what I did is that I started to study where they were speaking about the train station. And the general director was using this word that is creating places of life, to bring life into train station. And they got inspired by you guys in Saint-Pancras with the piano, you know.
Oh, yes.
So art was present in a way.
So you persuaded the railway company that to make the station during this period of transition more interesting, it would be good to add the art in. Then it's complicated because you have to do the art without the trains coming through. So that I'm sure there's lots of negotiations that go on. How long before you could start putting in the art after your initial idea?
So I had the idea, in 2013, and I engaged the talk maybe with them a year after, and it took us a year to bring it to life. So it was pretty quick.
It's quick, but it's still 2 years of negotiating and getting everything ready.
Pretty much a year, I would say, of negotiation. The time before was like to analyze, be sure, go into the train station. Then I saw that there were some murals, but from an high school, you know, and I was like, okay, it works, but it's not aesthetically beautiful, and there is amazing painters all around us, so why not bringing them there? You know, like Gare du Nord, and initially that's the thing, was the headquarters of the anti-graffiti brigade, so it's like symbolically not working at all in their mindset. But I came to them and told them, like, look, you have the main train station in Europe. It's 800,000 people a day, pretty much 775. In 12 days, the flux of people going there is the equivalent of the people you have in the Louvre in 1 year. So it's an amazing way to bring art into people's life. And I think this number helped them to realize the potential of the immateriality of the place, you know, and how sink it in a more open way, you know, how to reinvent functionality for the train station.
When people come from the UK to Paris, they arrive at Gare du Nord, and Gare du Nord is their entry point into Paris. It's an interesting neighbourhood anyway. It's got a rich and mixed African community there, Moroccan, people from all across North Africa. There are new hotels going in. It's an area of change. Did you feel that the art was part of this new story for the whole area as well?
We did a fresco that is an homage to the Tamul neighbourhood that is still alive right now. When you're going to take the subway, that's line number 2. You have this big wall painted on a tangerine color, and it's an homage to symbol from the Tamul neighborhood in a spiritual way, you know. And we had people coming and putting plants. Some people did prayers in front of the wall. I mean, there was this performativeness of the art we did. And what's amazing is that right now, 5 years after this residency, every day we have people that are sharing pictures on Instagram and associating it to our work, to the artist's work, and to the French National Railway. So it still touched people, you know.
And tell me, since that initial project in the railway station, you've been asked to do other projects and become involved with other schemes elsewhere. Just tell us a little bit about that.
We collaborated with more than 200 artists now since 5 years. We were like association, and then we changed it to a proper company, administratively and financially speaking, 3 years ago. Last year, we did pretty much 45 operations from doing murals on the rehabilitation program, working with Chanel on the massive wood panels. We worked with brands and we worked with city, and the idea is like, we did the gain a heart into a train station, Paris Saint-Lazare this year, and Gare de l'Est. So the activity is growing.
And tell me, has the appreciation and understanding changed? Because I think in many cities, you said the SNCF, they understood in the end. But in many cities, I think people still associate street art with graffiti, and they're unsure that they want it in their neighborhood. What does it mean? Do you think now that Paris is kind of cool with the whole topic, or are they still kind of wondering?
I think it's like we're, you know, sometimes in France, we're a bit late. We are traditionalist in a way, you know, it's like we don't really understand what's the meaning of art. I mean, I don't want to be pretentious here, but it's like whenever in history you have a new form of art, people react in an epidemic way, you know, Courbet, the origin of the word, was refused, you know. Graffiti, because it comes from the street, we speak about these people like being street artists. Okay, but when you look at the statue at the Tuileries, they are art in the public space, so they are street art. And how artists, you know, maybe they come from the street, but not all of them, and they still paint on canvas. They are artists, you know, administratively speaking, and they're contemporary. So they are contemporary artists. It's just like, where you look at creativity is not where it was, and it disturbs people. And I do really believe that people want to frame art in a box, you know. But the thing is, we speak about first art, second art, third art, seventh art will be cinema, and then video games. And we can't stop hierarchizing reality. But the thing is, art by its definition, it's boiling, it's exploding, it's going out of the frame. And thinking like that, you sometimes in a really brutal way, you're going to send artists to prison, you're going to react like the British government with rock and roll and forbid it, and people are going to try to resist. But what it means in our everyday life is that we are missing opportunity. I don't think it has value, you know, to forbid or hierarchize art too much. I mean, do you think opera has more value than a traditional African song? I mean, that's of your taste, you know, and I mean, that's a judgment, that's a subjective, but it needs to be considered with the same respect. Like, for example, electronic music, we couldn't understand it. We associated it with drugs, but I mean, people were taking drugs listening to rock and roll. What happens? In France, we don't have any big events. You have ADE in Amsterdam. You have the Sonar Festival in Barcelona. Sonar Festival is 126,000 people going there, companies, partnership with the NASA, MIT Lab, Google Magenta, deep learning to think about the future of music. This is reality. This is economy. This is territories getting attractive because we create value around artistic intelligence. And what happened with street art? In Tourcoing, this is a city up north France, you will never stop. But maybe you know the story of Wynwood, you know, in Miami. It was an abandoned field. Promoters were like, how are we going to attract people there? Bring companies, like make it, you know, sexy in a way. How are we going to make it that people want to live there? And it starts thinking that maybe, you know, developing art into the public space will make it. Now it's 3 million people going there every year. In Montreal, it's 1.5 people going to the Art Mural Festival. And in Vancouver, pretty much the same. So I guess, you know, we should be more open to new form of creativity and not react in an epidemic way. Ubisoft, video game, we are not listening to it. Their ship now is in Canada because they create the opportunity for them to go there. So we lost a massive opportunity. And I think it's stupid.
So you still want Paris to take this moment and this idea and be a bit more open as a city to new types of creativity?
I think the mindset is changing and we are participating to this change. And I mean, we are not the one that started. We are actors of the movement because there is artists that are painting in the street since years. But the partners we're working with, for example, real estate players, a lot, we're going on meetings and meetings and convincing them to bring this change. For example, yesterday I was meeting and presenting our work to 50 communication directors from the WIG Europe and France Construction Group, is one of the leaders worldwide as a real estate player and city builder. And we presented in a way that make them feel confident that we could work with them technically, artistically, communicate in a good way and be professional. I think this was a sector not professionalized too much. We are really a producer here, you know, like we're producing art into the public space, not just because we are bringing art into inside companies, but there is new generation now of urbanist planners. There is a new generation that is leading cities, and these people, you know, understand a bit more our culture and is a bit more open to it.
That was Jonas Ramuz from K36. Thank you for joining us. Well, that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Rabello and David Stevens. David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's episode, who else but Culture Club? Here's Karma Chameleon. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.